One of our clients set up their stocking mechanisms to follow Taylor Swift's concerts. And wherever Taylor Swift's concerts were, they would focus on the store in that area and increase their stock. And it worked.
Welcome to B2B Commerce Uncut, a journey through change. On this podcast, we have honest, hard-hitting conversations with thought leaders, distributors, and innovators in digital commerce and transformation. We explore not only the success, but also the challenges that manufacturers, distributors, and wholesalers can face in achieving successful digital transformation for their companies. This episode is brought to you by Oro, a leading innovator and provider of customer-driven, powerful, and connected open-source software for B2B digital transformation. Oro seeks to build long-term, trustful relationships with its customers, integrators, developers, and technology partners by empowering people with the best tools to digitalize their business. Find out more at oroinc.com. That's OROINC.com. And here's your host, Aaron Sheehan.
Welcome back to the B2B Uncut podcast, sponsored by Oro Commerce. I am your host, Aaron Sheehan. And with me today is Chantel, and I think I'm saying it right, but you correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, you totally right. Chantel's Wiser.
Chantel's Wiser. Okay. And Chantel has an awesome resume and background in the B2B space on the data side coming to us. She has quite a pedigree. We've had maybe six people this year or in the last 12 months with a Grainger connection. I'll let you talk about that a little bit. But boy, that name has come up a lot. As always, nice. We've had a lot of McMaster Car. Now we'll get some Grainger. Yep, also a famous name. So I'd love to give you a chance to introduce yourself. Tell us, what do you know and what do you do, Chantel?
All right, sounds good. Yeah, so Chantel Swiser. I'm the practice director at Pivotree for Strategic Data Services. And so what it really comes down to is I have a team of taxonomists and we help people organize their data, especially product data, you know, building out taxonomies to organize attributes to describe your products, building out web taxonomies to make things more findable, and everything in between, filling in the data, normalizing it, making it all pretty, tying it up with a bow so people can have wonderful customer experience on downstream websites. So that's what I do now. And then in my previous lives, like as you mentioned, Grainger, I got my start there. And that's really where I dove into product data. I had an art degree and didn't really that you can't really make a lot.
So I've heard.
Yeah, right? Oh, man, that was a tough one. Art, I love you still. But there is an art to data, though. So I see it play into these things quite often. But yeah, I got my start at Grainger, fell in love with organizing the chaos that is product data, trying to herd all the cats, get all the data from the different manufacturers and getting it into our system. And did that for about 8 years. Went over to Schneider Electric, where I was working for a manufacturer, getting the data to distributors. So got to see both sides of the fence there. And then I went over to the consulting side. And I've been doing like payment limitations, mostly taxonomy work, and then managing taxonomy teams, helping companies get their product data looking pristine and lovely.
That is pretty awesome. I'm curious, you said there's a nice alliteration to a team of taxonomists, and it made me wonder, what's the plural? You have a murder of crows, or like a herd of, what's the plural form of taxonomists? Let's invent something.
That's a good question. We can have fun with that. I don't know. I'm going to have to think about it.
We'll have to come up with it. If we do come up with something, I promise listeners, we will put it in the show notes if we come up with something. And if not, you'll just follow us both on LinkedIn because we'll then post it on LinkedIn. You mentioned Schneider Electric. Actually, we had Stephen on, I guess it's been a year and a half now from Schneider, big name industry as well. In fact, I think he might be coming back on soon, possibly, which would be awesome. Very cool. It's interesting, your background, because we've had people who are listening to the podcast. If you're subscribed, please, by the way, as they say, mash the like and subscribe button and leave us a nice review. But if you've been paying attention to the Oro Commerce B2B Uncut podcast, you'll notice that we've had, last year we went through this run of like lots of supply chain people. And like this year seems to be the theme of like product data. So we've had a lot of PIM, product data folks. I haven't had anybody who identifies as a taxonomist though. So that's pretty awesome as a job title. You know, Jason Hine, of course, you know, a lot of overlap between you guys. I see you following each other and engaging with each other's content on LinkedIn all the time. The problem this raises for me is that I've asked all of the obvious questions about product data and PIMs and things like that. So I'm going to have to sort of like revert to asking you weird existential questions instead of like obvious, you know, what's a category type questions. So I was looking at your LinkedIn and I noticed that you spent about 20 years or so in B2B, which is a lot of time fixing other people's spreadsheets, I have to say, because if you're doing a lot of data work, that's pretty much, I imagine, what a lot of your time is probably spent in.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a saying that all business software competes with Excel. Excel is your number one, no matter what it is that we're building and selling. And this is absolutely true for us on the e-commerce platform side. It's definitely true on the PIM side. Why is the spreadsheet still the default medium for schlepping data?
I think it's what we're used to it. And we get so good at the different functions, you know, concatenating things, using VLOOKUPs, using pivot tables. We can be wizards in there and work magic in there. And then once you get to these new systems, you have to relearn it all over again. Like as simple as going from Excel to Google Sheets, there's a huge learning curve just in that going from one system to another spreadsheet to another spreadsheet. So I think we're all so used to Excel that we don't want to step away from it. I grew up driving a stick shift manual car. And then one day I had an Uber pick me up and I couldn't even figure out how to open the sucker. I couldn't figure out how to open the door. So it's like that. My manual car is my spreadsheet. And then when you go into a new PIM and then you try to start to figure out how you used to do the things you used to do, you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. Help.
So That's a pretty great metaphor, actually. And I wonder if AI is going to become the automatic transmission in this metaphor, where folks will no longer need to worry about VLOOKUPs and pivot tables and things like that, because data manipulation will just happen via prompt.
That's true.
And inside, you know, hey, I need to know like this piece of information, and the LLM goes and analyzes and tells you, and you don't have to write macros anymore. Like, what a sort of scary and glorious and terrifying future. You know, you build your career around some like niche forbidden knowledge of like how to manipulate a spreadsheet, and then it's like irrelevant. And I don't know, like, how does that make me feel the way that I would feel if I grew up driving a stick, which I did, and switched automatic. And I haven't seen a manual transmission car for sale in probably 20 years. Used, maybe, but like new, can you even buy one? Listeners, call in, email us, chat us, say something. Like, have you bought a manual transmission in the last 15 years? You may be eligible for a class. No, I mean, but it's possible that somebody out there is still driving one that's not like a refurb antique, but that's pretty great. So you mentioned art in your intro. When we were talking in the green room previously, you know, you have a lot of hobbies, which really stood out to me. You know, a lot of folks in the B2B space were pretty boring people. And so your list of hobbies was like pretty engaging. You mentioned art, you mentioned watercolors, you mentioned nature, you mentioned archery, which is pretty cool. You talked about a lot of hiking and camping and being outdoors. I know I'm leaving something out there. And so I'll ask the obvious question on a podcast like this, which is, how many spreadsheets do you maintain for managing all those hobbies? And then what's the connection between the hobbies and the day job? There's got to be some kind of line that like, a tendency that sort of connects these things.
There's definitely some lines in there. There are a lot of spreadsheets. We have spreadsheets for managing our travel, for managing our investments, for managing our household tasks. And on the fun side, for some of the nature stuff, I do a lot of conservation volunteering. And there was this one volunteer project I did for a couple years that was focused on what's called phenology. And that's I was in charge of one site, so one nature preserve, and I would go hiking there every week and I would track what wildflowers, native wildflowers, were blooming that week, and then how long they bloomed, roughly how many blooms there were. And you track all of this on a spreadsheet along with some other things like the temperatures, the rainfall, and all that fun stuff to watch for patterns over years. And we had decades and decades of data to look at and just watch the patterns over the years for the different sites and the different flowers. That was super, super cool.
Kind of amazing, really, and terrifying. It seems like SQL might be a good choice for data. So are you saying there's an Excel spreadsheet that had been maintained for that many years, or the data was in some tabular format and then you were converting it to spreadsheet?
It's in spreadsheets. Like some of the older ones were like in just notebooks, pretty much, like the really, really old ones, the decades and decades old ones. But then it was all converted into spreadsheets. And yeah, and it's still being maintained in spreadsheets as far as I know today.
Oh, that's awesome. I have a similar story, actually. This is totally irrelevant to the topic, but it's the first opportunity I've had to bring it up. I got my degree in geosciences. So I spent a lot of time in the field in college, post-military for me. And one of the projects we had was digitizing cemetery data. And so the ladies of the county had for decades been putting together these books, these paper books of where all of the grave plots were in this Kansas in rural Tennessee, this county, and you know, it had been settled in the 1700s. And so there are all these graves on like family plots or just like in the middle of nowhere in a field somewhere. And someone had gone through family name and written everything down. And we had to digitize that. And then we had to go out with GPS devices, and we were building a database basically to put into a GIS set to then be accessible to residents of the county to go in, because there's, of course, tax implications to have dead people on your property. We got to drive around in a four-wheel drive vehicle, drop out in the middle of nowhere, scan, digitize all this offline data, take these paper books, turn them into data. Very similar sort of project, except that the gravestones don't change very much like flowers do. There's no blooming going on, I would say. At least, God, I hope not. It's a different movie if gravestones are blooming. That's pretty cool. And the through line, I guess, is you need to categorize things. Is that the...
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Like with the flowers, like you have, you know, the Leonian taxonomy that is the classification of all things biological. So you have the Leonian taxonomy and you're classifying your wallflowers to that taxonomy. So you have to identify them, figure out what flower they are, and then track them over time. And I used to actually photograph them and post them on an Instagram, and I would have fun facts about this particular flower. And even one of my photographs became the calendar cover one year for that district's calendar. So that was really cool too.
All right. It ties back to the art background. Yeah. You said Linnean. That's Linnaeus?
I'm not going to be able to say it. Linnaean. Now that I'm thinking about it, I can't say it.
It was a trap all along. Perfect. I know that guy. Yeah. I think I went to school with him. That's pretty awesome. So you're switching gears. When I was looking at, again, because I troll everybody's LinkedIn profile before we record, because I could get a sense of the person or the person. A sense of what that person wants to communicate to the outside world. Not always the same thing, I found. Although I think it is for you. You mentioned digital data transformation, the phrase digital data transformation, like several times. It shows up over and over again in like your sort of synopsis and then in your job descriptions. And I've seen data transformation or digital transformation many times. And I've seen data transformation many times. Digital data transformation is a new one for me. So like you said it so many times in your bio. What is that? Is it? Are you trying to get people to stop using spreadsheets, or what's the?
That's pretty much what it is. Trying to get people to go out of their homegrown legacy systems, whether it be spreadsheets, or I've even seen people have paper catalogs where they write notes down about product data, and sometimes SQL databases or just homegrown type of like systems they put together, to get into a more mature system that is going to make it easier to organize your data, manage your data, govern your data, and send it to all your downstream channels.
Makes sense. I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. I'm gonna play the part of somebody that I have had to deal with many times over the years, which is what's wrong with my homegrown system? It's worked for 40 years. It was good for my pop, and we run this distribution business now for 40 years on the back of like little green notebooks. Why do I want a mature system? That just sounds like a reason for me to spend money on something I don't need.
And we hear that all the time. And the big thing there is scalability. If you want to stick with just selling, you know, like a couple thousand products, then you're probably fine in a spreadsheet. But if you want to scale up and sell like a million SKUs, then yeah, you don't want to manage that in a spreadsheet. It's just not scalable. It's not easily governed over time. It doesn't have all the pretty dashboards to manage your KPIs and all that fun stuff, unless you have some really nifty macros, which you can do in Excel with that.
There is a row limit. I just want to say there is a row limit in Excel, guys. So, you know,
there are
limits to the scalability.
Exactly. Yeah. Very good call.
You know what the Excel row limit is?
Is it not?
It's a little over a minute. It's a very specific sort of like number that's based on, I think, you know, bytes basically. But yeah, it's like a million and change.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So yeah, and there are distributors out there with multiple millions of products. And so you can't get there with Excel. So hard.
We can have multiple spreadsheets, but then, oh goodness,
interrupting. Oh, there we go. What if we had multiple spreadsheets with a spreadsheet that tracks the multiple spreadsheets?
Well, there we go.
I don't need a PIM. I want to talk about a subject that's near and dear to me, which is food. I follow you on LinkedIn. I saw you had a post 2 weeks ago, I think it was, something like that. I've lost track of time. You posted and you posted a picture. You said you do an annual pantry reorganization. I love that. By the way, this is bouncing all over the place topically.
I promise you, listeners,
there this is going somewhere. What is the first step of a pantry reorganization for you?
So the first thing, and I did have a before at picture, but I totally shamed myself into not posting it, and I should have, darn it. Okay, so preface, I have four boys, ages 11 to 14 years old, and they are evil little pantry goblins. They open bags of cereal in there that inevitably fall and get crushed on the floor, half-eaten sleeves of Ritz crackers, like they completely put things away wherever is most convenient and everything, so no data governance, or no governance in terms of the pantry whatsoever in our household.
Shocking.
Oh man, it's bananas. So the first thing I do is I get
literal bananas in some cases. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Sometimes actual bananas. Sometimes really old bananas that you find behind something after months, and that's a terrifying experience. But the first thing I do is I have to clear off the floor of the pantry. Take everything off the floor, put it onto a table, sweep it all up, make the floor nice and tidy. And then I empty one shelf and put everything on the table. And then I designate that shelf for something. Okay, this one's going to hold the pasta and the pasta sauce and my olive oil, and start putting everything throughout the whole pantry onto that shelf. And then go to the next shelf. Same thing. Here's where I'm going to keep all my refried beans and my tortillas and my salsa and all that fun stuff. That's the shelf. And just keep on going systematically throughout the whole pantry until everything has a category and is well organized and looking pretty. And that usually lasts about 2 or 3 days before the pantry goblins and start to make chaos once again.
That makes sense to me. And I will just say that I did, I think, 2 nights ago, take a half-empty sleeve of Ritz crackers and put it somewhere where it shouldn't have been. So I am maybe a pantry goblin in that sense. Maybe it's just a male thing. I don't know. But it was like, to be fair, it was like 2 a.m. So if you're doing digital data transformation and you're working on the strategic data services team, your customers have, I guess it's fair to say, people who work with you have large catalogs.
Yes,
that definitely. Maybe the catalog, the product goblins have gotten into, and probably pretty fair statement to me. That's why they're talking to you. Companies that are successful at growing their SKU count, but maybe not emphasizing the importance of concise, clean data, the right, you know, properly structured product relationships and categorization and such like. When you walk into a new sort of a new customer engagement, or you're starting a job because you've had this job, you've worked both sides, right? You're on the services side now, but you've been sort of like merchant side, as we call it, in a software biz. What are the first few set of questions you ask to evaluate how much of a mess this is going to be? How much does that connect to your sort of pantry reorganization system of deciding categorization? I'm just curious how these like connect.
Yeah, so I'll start by asking them roughly like how many categories do they have? How many SKUs do they have? And that gives you a rough idea of the size of the product data. And then how are they managing that product data today? What system is it in? What governance processes do they have today? Like, are they doing cyclical taxonomy audits to make sure it's staying clean? Like, where are their pain points? What's really keeping them up at night when they start thinking about their product data? And all of that will start to point to where there's opportunities to make their lives easier. So if we find out that they have a homegrown legacy system, but it's actually, you know, 5 different spreadsheets and they have duplicate data points in all of those spreadsheets, but they need all of this data somewhere, then that points to a problem. They need a centralized repository. If they have a really long onboarding time because they're a distributor and they're trying to collect data from all these different suppliers and they can never get the data and it's on all these different formats, you know, then you need a good vendor onboarding process and maybe even a vendor portal to help herd all those cats and organize that data and a strong team to normalize that data. And then I've even had customers where like they go through this whole process and then we let them go. Their data is beautiful and pristine. They don't have any data governance. So 3 years later, they come back and they're like, yeah, can you do that again?
Somebody put the husband put the Ritz crackers in the wrong place. Like the parallels here are eerie, actually. So right. What you're saying is that in both cases, the pantry reorganization and the data reorganization, you sort of start with a desired data structure. I mean, how many jars of olive oil do I have? How many jars of pasta sauce do I have? How many bananas do I have, et cetera, right? Exactly. And you're designating in your systems, whatever the systems are, this data goes here, this data goes here. And yes, you're making it at the category level, let's say, or the supplier level, maybe if it's a, well, they're probably doing it at the supplier level to start with and hoping to get away from doing that and have a normal data structure that's supplier agnostic to some extent. It just takes a long time to get there. But so you're going through the sort of the same steering process, I guess it's fair to say, of what do you want your goal to be? And you're taking stock of what they have and you're sort of like basically building a roadmap to get from data chaos to data cleanliness.
Yep, exactly. No, I love that. Definitely. Current state, future state. And here's the dotted line to get there.
Yeah. What's the biggest SKU count you've ever had to clean up?
7.5 million. That was a beast.
Ooh, yeah, we got a customer with 7.5 million SKUs, actually. I don't think it's the same one, but maybe we can talk offline and whether it's the same customer.
There we go.
Happily, they're happily on Oral Commerce and have been actually for quite some time. Forklift parts, same guy?
Nope. Electrical products, electrical component.
Okay, totally. This data was clean then. Yeah, we're fine. So have you ever had to walk away from a prospect or an engagement because they like weren't ready to do the work? Because this is a lot of work.
It is. It's a ton of work. And there's been times where we've suggested, instead of just diving into the work, and actually I'd say we do this fairly often, we start off with discovery, like a discovery project. For a month, we're going to dive in and we're going to comb through your data, find out where, show you where all the issues are. We're going to do a bunch of stakeholder interviews, which really turns into like data therapy sessions. They can tell us everything that's making them crazy in their current state today and what they would love to see in the future. And we help them put together like, here's all the things that are the problems. Here's what we recommend to fix them, and we'll help them build a case for getting funding for those projects, because a lot of times that's the biggest hurdles. You'll have a champion and then getting the C-suite to be like, okay, let's write a check for a whole bunch of money can be a difficult one. So that's usually where we'll start. I have had projects where we get through discovery and we even get started on projects. And, you know, we're consultants. We never drop a project, but we might opt to not have a next SOW just because they're just not digitally mature enough. They're not ready. They don't really want change. You start going in talking about an attribution taxonomy and they're like, oh, well, I don't want to do it this way. Like, it's kind of like the same thing with spreadsheets. Like, I've been doing it this way forever. Why do I have to change? And they don't want to change. So you don't want to waste any more of their money if they're not going to be ready. We'll try to socialize the project as much as possible. We'll try to show them the benefits of it. And like 99 out of 100 times, people get on board. But every once in a while, there's somebody that just does not want to move forward.
To the earlier conversation, right? You're asking people to switch from a stick to an automatic, or you're asking people to switch from Excel to some kind of system. And it's always, I think this is something, and I see this a lot, I've been doing for a long time and technology for a long time. And there's always a sort of tax to adopting a new way of working where you become less efficient. It's like hiring somebody. It's like growing a team. You don't just add people and suddenly you are exponentially more effective as a group just by adding headcount. There's actually a dip in productivity, the dip in throughput, because you're learning new things. And so, and I think that dip while you're picking up the new structure is something that turns people off. I definitely feel that on the operations side, I definitely feel that. Is that also the case for like product data management? Is there maybe this is a question you're not supposed to ask a services company, like, but we're going to do it anyway because we're all about,
all good.
This is the B2B Uncut podcast, and so we're not cutting the truths here. Like when someone is undergoing change management, a big change management, like MDM, like master data management, right? That's what it stands for, right? I think, yep.
Yep, you got it.
Yep. Master data management. Got it. Yeah, thought so. See, I listen to a lot of smart people. I'm not one myself, but I interview a lot of them. And so, is there a point at which the team is so busy onboarding the new stuff that it feels like they're sliding backwards and like, why am I spending money? I'm going backwards, and they can't see the vision.
There definitely is times like that. And then there's always the fear of, okay, well, if we make everything so much more efficient, am I still going to have a job? So sometimes you get that little bit of a pushback too, because if you have a whole team that is in charge of gathering all the data from your suppliers and organizing it, and then we make a way to do it that's much more efficient, then maybe you don't need that quite that big of a team to be managing all of that data. So there's that little bit of a fear of, okay, am I going to lose my job? And we all come across that. We have tooling right now at my current company where you can use AI to build out schemas. So like for this Angelus muscle stuff, I can say what this is into this little tool, and it spits out all the attributes you need for it. Where we used to do competitive analysis and go research the products, and we would manually put those schemas together. Now we can get them like this, but of course we always need a human in the loop to QA it and make sure it looks good, make sure the machine didn't mistake it for totally like for protein powder or something like that.
Or if there's regulatory compliance type stuff that's associated with it, maybe you almost like from a risk management standpoint, you need to have someone reviewing it to make sure that it's got the right disclaimers and the right, you know, California warning labels and stuff like that on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think everyone has that fear of becoming more efficient and making things happen faster because they do worry about their jobs. But we always try to like tell them that we don't want to take your jobs away. We want to make your job more efficient so you can concentrate on more important things. And like auditing the data or making your user experience more successful or any of those things.
Oh, okay. So you mentioned the magic word, phrase, which is user experience. I think it's fair. I got into a little debate online a few days ago about this. You know, to some extent, customer experience is the driver of all the rest of the sort of good green arrows that point up in terms of business health, your lifetime value per account, your customer satisfaction, directly, you know, revenue and retention and things like that. People work with companies where they like the experience of working with that company. And they don't work. The corollary is they don't work with companies where they don't like the experience of working with that company. E-commerce is obviously near and dear to me. So I think it's pretty much been said many times on this podcast, but I don't think we can take credit for it here. This is not breaking news that good product data helps you sell stuff. It's true in a paper catalog. It's true online, right? It's true on a shelf. If I walk into a store and like, where I expect to see alphabetical products in an alphabetical. If I go to a bookstore and I'm looking for a book, I'm expecting to see books categorized by the first letter of the last name of the author, right? Let's say, you know, inside of a particular subject matter. Findability, yes, or discoverability. If you're, depending on what your billable rate is. If your billable rate is higher, you say discoverability, Chanel.
Oh, there we go. Know.
Yeah. So you should ask for a raise, right? Using that. But I have found that supplier data that you get, you mentioned this sort of use case a minute ago, that the data that you get from your supplier is often, it's a technical term, crap. And I mean, I taught a lot of my customers, I've had this conversation for years and years and years. I've got 500 CSV files basically from different suppliers, and they're all categorized completely differently. I've got fields missing. I've got people who concatenate values together, people who don't. Field length limits that truncate like descriptions in the mid-sentence and stuff like that. You mentioned user experience. What makes a good user experience when it comes to that specific use case of if I'm a buyer and I'm buying from a distributor who's representing a bunch of suppliers, what's a good user experience for that buyer? How do they want to, how do you think they want to see the data?
No, I think, well, first, like you mentioned, the findability, they want to be, or discoverability, they want to be able to find that product fast. And they want to make it like, you want to be able to click through the taxonomy or search through the search bar, and it should be very intuitive, very quick, have some, you know, auto completions and all that fun stuff. And then you want good filters that actually matter to you. Like I'm looking up this chapstick and I like my chapstick to be vanilla flavored. So there better be a flavor filter up there for me to find all the vanilla flavored chapsticks. You want to make sure the filters are there. And then when you get to your product, you want to make sure that all the data there answers all the questions you might have about that product. And so all that goes into making sure your data is complete, that it's clean, concise, clear, all of the C's. And that has a big effect on also if your product is going to be even findable. If you have three different companies selling chapsticks and company A fills in all of their data, company B fills in like half of it, and company C like barely fills anything out, when someone goes to filter for vanilla, company A is going to win because their product is going to pop up when that filter is selected for vanilla. Because company B and C didn't have that data in there, that product is now completely invisible to that filter and it's not going to get selected. So company A is going to win the market share and they're going to get the revenue. And those other guys, they're going to miss out. So definitely important to have all of those C's because it is going to have a huge impact on the findability of your products and whether or not people have the information they need to make a confident purchasing decision.
That's perfect. I would say we serve a wide B2B audience here at Aura Commerce who listen to this podcast. So we have, so I would say manufacturers and suppliers, those of you listening, you just heard her say, and this isn't live yet, but the episode immediately preceding this, actually that he said the same thing, which was search and product data, it drives revenue an incredible amount because of this fact. So like if you're a supplier or manufacturer, please provide complete data, right? And have some understanding of like how the end user is finding your stuff and make sure you fill that in. If you're a distributor and all your suppliers are not doing this, please invest the time. Because the other thing I see all the time in this use case is maybe everybody has the flavor of vanilla, Chantel, but uppercase V vanilla, lowercase V vanilla, V period, misspa, V-A-N-I-L-L-L-L-L-A, vanilla in Spanish, you can see, right? And there's a lot of, you know, an e-commerce system, any system does what you tell. So if I take a spreadsheet and I import it and it's just like, oh, here's a new value in an attribute that I've never seen before, but I guess I'll use it because it's what you put in. Computers do what you tell them regardless. And so if you're a distributor listening to this, please take the time to look at your product data and understand, like, do I have the right data presented for my buyer for them to make an educated decision? And it's always interesting because I have run into some suppliers who have an amazing product, like very cost competitive, like good quality, and they can't win because no one can find their stuff because they didn't invest in this end of it. And this is one of the reasons why market leaders tend to keep market leading, because they take the time to sort of like do these little things that aren't immediately obvious necessarily on the manufacturing side, right? You're so busy building the right chapstick. It tastes great, low calorie. I don't know. I don't buy a lot of chapsticks, so I'm not sure. It's got the right flavor. It doesn't like, you know, cause you to grow like a third eye or something, which is important in chapstick. So good user experience is good data.
Yes. Gotta have good data.
Gotta have good data. Totally agree. This is going really quickly too, because we both talk fast. And when I am interviewing somebody who talks fast, I speed up. I match the person I'm with. So I'm just going to apologize in advance to our production team, who is probably going to have to turn the BPM down on this podcast to get it to a point where it's listenable. So for the audience, so people who are listening, I'm sorry. I want to ask you sort of like one final serious question, and then I'm going to ask you a surprise non-serious question at the end.
All right.
So the final serious question is, when we were talking earlier, meaning prior to this recording, you used a word that I recognized but did not understand the context in which you were using it. And you said that you were doing, and this is where, like, if this was a TV show, we'd play the harp sound that indicates we're flashing back to an earlier moment in like Bewitched. So you said the word ontology. I know that word from philosophy class a very long time ago. And we use the word ontology to talk about metaphysics, like the study of being or whatever. But you said it not in that context. I was like, what is she talking about? So when you say ontology, what do you mean? And what do you know about the ontology of wildflowers? You talked about this a little bit. I want to hear more.
Very nice. An ontology is really a collection of taxonomies that are linking together. So you have your different taxonomies to classify different entities. So you can have a taxonomy to classify your wildflowers. And then you might have another taxonomy that is like organizing and classifying all of your nature preserve sites. And so you would have a link there where this nature preserve site blooms these specific wildflowers. And that kind of turns into an ontology. And then you can have other taxonomies into your ontology to be more descriptive, to link more data and make it all magical and give you all sorts of fun data. And then you can even bring it up to the next level after ontologies, knowledge graphs. And then you're bringing in links into these other systems of data, like weather data. And I can bring that in there. And then that would make my phenology spreadsheet pretty much obsolete. If I had all that stuff in there, that would collect all the data I need for everything. And it'd be easy peasy.
Your answer then makes me want to ask another question. I have heard the phrase knowledge graph many times. I think I know what it means. I'm not 100% sure. I wonder if any of our listeners know and would like to know. So this is an opportunity for you to explain what is knowledge graph.
So it's an ontology plus. So it links to, it's an ontology, so a collection of a bunch of different taxonomies and them all linked together. But then you have relationships to external knowledge bases. So the Weather Channel, if they have a database, you can connect to the Weather Channel. You can connect to Google and be able to get all of their search and connected data. You can connect to your local library and see what kind of books they have in stock, for example, or something like that. So you're connecting to these other external databases, and it's using like machine learning and AI to help you create all those different links between all these different taxonomies. It's a much smarter, more intelligent version of these ontologies. So rather than doing a lot of manual curation of all of this taxonomy work, it's doing it a little bit more automagically.
Let's apply this to the wildflower domain, because I understand concepts easier when I have sort of like a concrete analogy to use. So are you ready for this? I bet you can do this, right? If I'm saying, what is an ontology? Or let's start with taxonomy. We use that word many times. In fact, as you said, you are a flock of taxonomists, I think.
Yes, taxonomists. Actually, taxonomist of the year a couple years ago. Woohoo, crown.
Oh, that's an award you can get? That's awesome.
It's the only award in our world, and it's out of London. And yeah, taxonomist of the year.
Okay, forget the question I was going to ask. Like, how do you get taxonomist of the year? Like,
someone nominates you, and usually there's X number of people nominated, and then there's a judging panel, and the judges choose the winner.
We should have led with this. So I'm asking the absolute right person. So let's go back to the wildflower example. A taxonomy of wildflowers would be the species, let's say.
Yeah, that Leonian taxonomy has this whole there's a mnemonic device that goes down the whole thing, like kingdom, domain, something. It ends with the pretty
phylum,
much.
Phylum, I think.
Yeah, phylum's in there. Yeah, I can't remember. There's a King George, I can't remember the something grape soda. And so it ends with species. Genus, species are the last two. For the life of me, I can't remember the middle ones. Oh, no, I got so distracted by that, I forgot the question.
I was asking the question. We're going to get here eventually, guys, I promise. Trying to understand the difference between a taxonomy, an ontology, and a knowledge graph. So a taxonomy is just a classification system of a thing. Right?
Yeah, of a specific entity. Yeah. So you can have a taxonomy for wildflowers. You can have a taxonomy for your products, a taxonomy for your customers, a taxonomy for your suppliers, of your locations. All of those could be different.
Basically, it's a set of categories or fields that describe it.
Yes.
How is that different from an ontology? Or are they the same thing?
So taxonomies are just standalones. They are describing one product. So in a PIM, you usually have a product taxonomy, and you organize all your products into that taxonomy to get specific attributes for that particular product. And then you have a customer taxonomy. That's usually, you know, like in a Salesforce or something like that. And you have all of the fields you need to describe your customers. So a lot of times these taxonomies are standalones. They're independent of these other taxonomies. Now, if you get into systems like MDMs, that's more of an ontology. You have your product taxonomy, your customer taxonomy, your vendor taxonomy, your location taxonomy, all in that system. And then you can link all of those taxonomies together. And that's what ultimately makes that an ontology.
Yes. Okay. So we wouldn't call that a relational database. That's how I think of it a little bit.
It's
the difference between an Excel spreadsheet and a relational database. So an Excel spreadsheet, one sheet contains a set of like field columns and rows describing a particular thing. And then a database is like a whole bunch of tables that describe those things, but they relate to one another. I might have keys that link them together, and I can for the purpose of understanding something about my data, I can run a query to the system that pulls information from multiple taxonomies, let's say, and gives me a piece of truth about both of them and how they relate to one another that they wouldn't individually contain.
Yeah, exactly. When I see customers' perfect history and give them a recommendation for a new product, you would link your customer and their products and your transaction history.
Exactly. So like if I want to see what products people in a specific location are ordering, I need to collate data from multiple tables together to pull that. Makes complete sense to me. What's knowledge graph?
So if you have this ontology here and now you want to add some additional information to it, but you don't want to manage it and you want it to be able to make smart links to everything in your ontology, that's where that comes into play. So one of our clients set up their stocking mechanisms to follow Taylor Swift's concerts. And wherever Taylor Swift's concerts were, they would focus on the store in that area and increase their stock. And it worked. That knowledge graph is bringing in an external set of information like Taylor Swift's concert tour schedule and helping it to inform other things within your data sets. So then they would move products to this specific location because Taylor Swift's schedule went this way.
That's, first off, it's amazing. Second off, my SEO team, thanks you so much for mentioning Taylor Swift. Like, you have no idea. We've been trying to figure out a way to shoehorn T-Swift into this podcast for 2 years and have not been able to do it. You're the first one to do it. Thank you so much. I know this episode is going to perform amazingly well when the Swifties find it. My 13-year-old will probably actually listen to this. She always wants to know what I do. And now I can sort of explain it in words that she will understand. That's really good. So the knowledge graph is just the ontology with external information. I've seen this in a sort of search and merch context where I have all the data about my products, but I might bring in data about climate. And so if someone in, let's say, the Pacific Northwest is searching for a jacket, I might look at the weather and I might bring an external piece of information in and I might show them, oh, it's wet, so I'm going to show them rain jackets. Whereas somebody in maybe a colder, snowier place, I might bring them heavier jackets. And it's an external piece of information. It's the context, right, for the data that matters because the queries have context, right?
Very true. Very true.
I love it. Okay. This has gone in a little bit of a different direction than I was planning, which is awesome. It's been very educational for me. I really appreciate it. I hope it's been educational for the people who are still listening at home. My one final question for you is the one I ask every guest at this point in the show, which is, what is one piece of media that you have read, watched, listened to, consumed in some way in the last few months that stood out to you that you would recommend to the audience? And it can be serious. If you've got a great textbook on ontologies and you're like, yeah, I've been reading this and it's really great, totally can. If it's, no, it's really just like Succession, that's fine too. Go for it. What do you have for the people?
So one recommendation I would have would be to check out Sam Russo on LinkedIn. She's an automotive data expert. So like automotive aftermarket parts and stuff like that, that it gets, there's fitment data and all this stuff. So like she's got some really cool content that I definitely would recommend people go take a look at. It's always very colorful and she's really good with visuals and I love her stuff. So I like that one a lot. So there's one totally not data related. If there's anyone out there that watches Love is Blind, I've been obsessed with that show and it just got done. We just had the reunion series and there's all these people on Instagram that kind of go back and review it and rate people on how well they performed or what they did on the show. And that's been my other local obsession for the last week was catching up on Love is Blind and just binge watching the whole season. And it's been awesome.
Got it. Sam Russo, Love is Blind. Got it. Pretty great. Okay. Look, Chantel, thank you so much for being on this episode of the B2B Uncut podcast. This was very educational, I think. And I think this was the right perspective on product data that we needed because we've been talking about it from a very sort of like pin-centric and data-centric perspective on the sort of the e-commerce first angle. This was a good, almost more existential and theoretical exploration of what this means, what the terms mean, how they relate to one another. We use lots of analogies, just like Jesus did, and it worked pretty well. We're still quoting him, so I guess that's probably a good way to tell a story about complicated things. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Where can people find you, and where can people contact you if they are interested in learning more about your flock of taxonomists?
Definitely, yeah. They can contact me on LinkedIn. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn, Chantel Swizer. And if you look up Chantel Swizer, I'm probably the only one that pops up. But if you look up Chantel Swizer and Pivotry and taxonomy, I'll definitely pop up. I have a YouTube where I talk about all things taxonomy and have a whole bunch of videos, a taxonomy boot camp, best practices, all sorts of fun stuff. So yeah, I would say check that out too. Contact me via LinkedIn or LinkedIn's probably the best way.
Okay, well, send me links to all those things. I'll make sure we get them in the show notes, including the YouTube channel and such, so people don't have to go looking. They can just click the thing. And I've always said that the B2B Uncut podcast moves product, is what I say when I'm asking for money from sponsors. So let's see. Let's make it happen, people. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your day. And it was a pleasure talking to you.
Same here. Good times. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to B2B Commerce Uncut, A Journey Through Change, powered by Oro. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Oro, a leading innovator and provider of customer-driven, powerful, and connected open-source software for B2B digital transformation. Oro seeks to build long-term, trustful relationships with its customers, integrators, developers, and technology partners by empowering people with the best tools to digitalize their business. Find out more at oroinc.com. That's OROINC.com.